Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
It's very clear there is a lot of work to be done, because the capitalist division of labor has also divided us. You know, we now are separated as producers, consumers. You know, we wear things that are made, you know, across the world, without us often having any idea of the condition under which they are made, of the situation of the people. You know, we throw away trash that might end up in the fields of an African farmer, you know, to poison their waters and so forth. So there's a tremendous work that we need to do, you know, to rethink our system of production and our system of production and our system of distribution and consumption so that we are not divided.
That's the voice of renowned author Sylvia Federici. And this week's show, we speak to Sylvia about how the capitalist enclosure movement went hand in hand with the witch hunts of the 16th and 17th centuries. We also speak about the modern day witch hunts and how they go hand in hand with the neoliberalism and the enclosure movement that continues. So stay tuned.
Dr. Sylvia Federici is with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you to you for inviting me.
It's such a pleasure. And to me, the capitalism, colonization, patriarchy seem to be a crisis that create the storm that we live in today. And you know, the two things seem very related, you know, the colonization, the ongoing violence against women, patriarchy as a kind of logic that governs our society. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your research, and you've done a beautiful job in your book, The Caliban and the Witch Women, The Body and Primitive Accumulation. You speak of the role of the witch hunts and the imposition of a separation of production for the market and production of human beings. What can we learn from the witch hunts of the 16th and 17th century?
Well, first, let me try to clarify that when we speak of witch hunts of this period, we are not referring, for example, only to the Salem witch hunts. In North America, I think there's not much understanding that witch hunting actually, in the U.S., in New England, was an episode limited to a few years, to a few trials, whereas in Europe, between, roughly speaking, 1500 to 1750, you know, for two centuries and a half, hundreds of thousands of women, you know, were arrested and charged with the most horrendous crime, you know, first of all, having made pacts to the devil and having conspired to destroy their neighbor, kill their children, you know, have killed their animals and destroyed their crops. And on that basis, all by magical means, and on that basis, they were tortured horrendously and eventually burnt at the stake. This is a phenomenon that I'll say it's unique in world history. I don't think there's been any other example of such a massive and prolonged persecution of women leading to the destruction of so many women's lives and the institution of a regime of terror towards women. Now, why? Why this is the case? I think, unfortunately, and I think this is a consequence of the patriarchal view that still dominates, you know, our culture. You know, it has not been, this phenomenon has not been the subject of the same amount of studies that has been dedicated, you know, to other historical realities. But the work that I have done has basically, you know, tried to understand what were the roots of this persecution, and also to understand that a puzzle that is very central to the question of witch hunting, which is how come that the target, who were often, you know, very poor women, many times the poorest in the communities, you know, peasant women, women from rural areas, sometimes beggars, you know, were accused of such horrendous time and were attributed such incredible power, fantastic powers. You understand it when you place this persecution in the historical and social context of the time, which were really the major, major historic transformation that were taking place throughout Europe and very soon in the Americas, that led to the formation, to the development of a capitalist society, which involved the breakdown of the communal forms of agriculture, communal forms of social relation that had prevailed throughout the Middle Ages, and also implied the imposition of a whole new, basically, form of social life and work discipline. And the thesis that I developed in my book, that I basically research, is that this is the connection that we have to focus upon in order to understand, you know, what the figure of the witch came to symbolize. And the argument is that the witch became a kind of concentrate of all the fears that the ruling elite, those who were engaged in this process and promoters of this process of transformation, had of the, you know, revolt, resistance, social rebellion that clearly accompanied the transformation.
Who are the witches today, and what are the stories silenced by histories that paint the road to capitalism as a natural process?
I'd like to elaborate a little bit more with the witch of the past and then look at the witch of today, because it's very clear, for example, that by the 1530s, 1540s, with the colonization of also South America, with the subjugation of the population in Mexico and a large part of what we call Peru, actually witch hunting was brought to the so-called New World, and it became really an instrument of the subjugation of the indigenous population, and particularly women. And it was particularly women because women were those who were, in a way, most resistant the social change that was being implemented. You know, the Spaniards brought with them also a very misogynous conception of women and a whole new sexual division of labor that basically deprived women of the power they had had, even in pre-colonial society. So looking back at the past, I think we gain many insights also about the present, because the witch hunt, in a way, was an attack on the whole community, but it was also especially, you know, an attack on women in the way it was basically instrumental, you know, to create a whole new organization of reproduction and a devaluation of the kind of activity, of the kind of values that women have been the carrier. And I think that today we see something very, very similar. It's very interesting that over the last decade, for example, or perhaps even more, in Africa, we have had a return of witch hunting. In thousands of women again have been persecuted, and they've been, in this case, we have not had trials. You know, the attack on women as witches has come from below. For example, in the northern part of Ghana, there are now witches camps. There are places where women have been accused in their villages of being witches, have been forced to go in a sort of exile. And it's interesting because you can see again that the context in which this is happening is very similar to the context that I researched, you know, in my work, which is these are many parts of Africa where the witch hunts have taken place, are areas that have been immensely popularized. They've been popularized because of many rounds of structural adjustment, the kind of economic policy, economic neoliberal policy that the World Bank, the IMF, you know, have imposed on African states, you know, which basically destroyed the local economy. We have had an increase in land expropriation and takeover by corporation of large territory for mining ventures or for agribusiness, more recently agri-fuel. So that what has begun to happen now in Africa is the breakdown of a communal system that in Africa, more than in any other part of the world, had survived, even though through many changes, throughout the colonial period, you know, almost into the present. And with that breakdown, what we see happening is, first of all, the breakdown of the communal land ownership system and with the inroad of monetary relation, what we see more and more is the devaluation of the subsistence economy, subsistence activities in which women have been involved. And there's evidence, and this is some of the work I've been doing more recently, there's evidence that there is a connection between these developments and the return of witch hunting. Again, the victims are poor women, usually in the rural area, older women. Sometimes they live alone, so they it's easy to, in fact, attack them. And these are women are engaged in subsistence economies. They may have a little piece of land. And with the excuses that echo very much, you know, the ideology of witchcraft in the 16th, 17th century. You know, you have now, you know, people who attack them and basically, in many cases, either chase them out of the villages or they kill them. What has been found out, there is a strange correlation between the areas in which this is taking place and the areas that are being dedicated, that are being devolved to commercial ventures, for example, game parking and so forth. So I've been very interested in tracing this connection and seeing how, in fact, the past can illuminate the present and vice versa. And I think it's very important to realize that internationally and historically, you know, the advent of capitalism, which is often seen as a evolutionary and beneficial development, particularly in the case of women, you know, as bringing progress to, you know, women's life. You know, in reality, when you look at it, the history, in reality, you see that in each case, there's been a deterioration, a drastic deterioration, and an increase in the differentiation between women's role and males' roles. And this basically accompanied by an attempt by the states, by an attempt by the new elite to control the female body, you know, to basically introduce, you know, new forms of control on sexuality. It's a tremendous fear that, for example, you see very clearly in the records of the witch trial of the 16th and 17th century, tremendous, tremendous fear of women's sexuality, women's sexual power. Because sexuality is seen as a kind of a subversive force, right, that can unite people across classes and also may have an effect on the discipline of labor. So the discipline in the woman is a way of discipline the sexuality, and it's a way of imposing a kind of regimentation of life where, you know, every activity, you know, in a sense, every energy the human beings have has to be expended productively. And I think when you see today what is happening with women today, we find that there's a tremendous still, the language has changed. You know, the violence against women is still very, very high.
I just want to talk about how are these communal ties being undermined and broken, particularly in Africa, when we think about the new role of capital and free flow of capital and the role of microcredits, you know, that has been introduced as the new savior in that region.
Oh, yes. I'm very glad you brought up this question because this has been a very, very pernicious policy. Yeah, I mean, for the last two decades, We have been told that microcredit is the new solution of poverty in the world, and especially poverty among women. Actually, microcredit is turned out to be a way that has plunged women across the globe even further into poverty, and more than that, has also contributed to destroy precisely those networks of support that women have created that have been so important to their survival. Basically, I think there's a tremendous misunderstanding among the general public about how microcredit work. You know, the idea is very simple and seem quite innocuous. You know, the argument is that, you know, women have all kinds of microactivities, particularly women in societies that have been very pauperized and where they don't have access to wage employment. You know, women have been creative in sometimes they may take over a piece of land, you know, grow some corn cobs, then they make some food, they make snacks, they sell it at the, you know, basically their neighbors, or they might buy, you know, a few tomatoes and onions and resell them. The idea has been that, okay, what these women really need is a little capital. We give them a few, maybe $100, and we give them this capital, and then they can lift themselves out of dire poverty. It seems very innocuous. It does not work the way. First of all, the banks, the international agencies who are promoting these programs have understood, you know, how powerful it is that women have created these communities. The women have these groups, these support groups. And so usually they give the loan to the group. They do not give the loan to the individual. And they make every person in the group responsible for the payment. So if I default, if I cannot come up with my payment, somebody else will have to pay for me. And already this has really created a relationship between women in, you know, instituting really forms of reciprocal self-policing. But the real problem begins with the fact that these loans are given at quite high interest rate, and that the fact that now women, this women's group, has a little bit more capital does not necessarily change, and that, for example, they can sell more tomatoes on the street does not necessarily change the power of the buyers, does not necessarily change the social context in which the activities are taking place. So few women are really able to benefit. What is taking place is actually women fall into debt. In fact, they have to borrow money from moneylenders in order to be able to pay back the interest that they owe and to pay back the loan that they owe. And what you see is that now these women are becoming more and more indebted instead of more empowered. You begin to see a breaking down of the support group. And there's something else that I should add, that the banks offer the microcredit. You know, when a woman does not default, you know, I've really studied, you know, all kinds of shaming tactics to force them to pay. And they've actually conducted studies about shaming ways, you know, so that you know how do you shame, you know, women in certain parts of Africa. What are the local codes that can be used, that can be implemented so that the shame is sent, you know, in a more burning way. So in some cases, for example, you know, I know I have a colleague who comes from Niger, and she recently returned and told me that in Niger, the banks actually put the pictures. But I've actually heard the same account from Bolivia, put the pictures of the women who have defaulted, you know, on in public, you know, in the bank. When you go in, you see the picture of the women have not been able to pay. So you're publicly shamed. And it's no wonder that they can boast that these women who receive this loan, who are among the poorest in the world, are also those who have the highest rate of repayment. Again, at the men's discourse, women have hanged themselves because they could not bear the shame. In Bangladesh, there are many cases, recorded cases, of husbands who have left their wives after their wives have taken the money out, and the husband had been able to benefit actually from the loan that they had taken, but then when the woman was not able to repay and she was publicly shamed, the husband left her. So women in several cases hanged themselves. Vandana Shiva has found that many of the farmers in India who have killed themselves in recent years, not being able to pay their debts.
When you talk about the witch, you also talk that the witch hunt was coincidentally along the sides of the enclosure.
That's right.
So I want to talk about the enclosure and how it not only isolates people from their livelihood, but also from one another. How do we create then a commons that is reflective of our needs for social interaction, interdependence, coexistence with one another? I mean, sustainability is something that we all need to be thinking about. Do you see signs of hope in the communities that you've studied, that you participate with?
First of all, you're absolutely right. It's not only when you have enclosure, when you have the breakdown of communal structure. It's not only the loss of land, it's a loss of a whole system of social relation that bonded people, as well as a loss of a whole culture and also relationship to the environment that is destroyed. I am encouraged by the fact that for some time now, you know, we have seen a new understanding, and this is an international phenomenon, and a new interest, for example, in the question of the commons, that I think more and more, partially as a response to neoliberalism, actually greatly as a response to neoliberalism, that has tried to put everything on sale, has tried to make the market basically the decisive factor in people's life and destroy all form of communal sharing of wealth and relations, entitlements. In response to that, you know, people are realizing that we need to reconstruct the commons. We need to reconstruct the commons not only in terms of reconstituting and reclaiming forms of communal wealth, but first and foremost, you know, reconstituting form of solidarity, of mutual aid. And very interesting, for all over the world now, we see the proliferating, the attempt to create alternative economies, you know, like time banks, you know, forms of bartering, creating local currencies. And even though often now these appear as small-scale experiments and don't seem to have yet the force of transforming the world, when we see the trend, we see them together, we understand that there's something that is at work. And I'm very encouraged by this phenomena. And I think also the new forms of struggle that we have seen, particularly this last year, the phenomenon of the square, the phenomenon of the Occupy movement, are pointing in that direction because they are showing people understanding that not only you need to come out in a rally, in a protest movement, but part and parcel of that protest movement, but also be an immediate transformation of our relationship with each other. You know, the fact of living together in the square, the phenomenon of the square, where people are really sharing their lives. They are not only coming together as abstract individuals unified by their opposition, but they are coming together with people who want to be with each other, who want to know each other, who are organizing a medical team. They are organizing food. They are organizing some entertainment for the children, that they are beginning to create certain forms, collective forms of reproduction. I think that this has been extremely important. You find the same desire and the same thrust also in the Occupy movement, where particularly in the period in which you had the encampments, you could see the kind of social relationship that were constructed, you know, as form of commoning, as form of basically reconstituted, you know, new forms of social cooperation, and starting with cooperation in the process of reproduction, which I think is extremely crucial, because this is where we have to start the reproduction, you know, of everyday life. And undoubtedly, a movement that is not able, you know, to reproduce itself, you know, is a movement that has no future. You know, but if we look on a broader scale, it's very clear there's a lot of work to be done, because the capitalist division of labor has also divided us. You know, we now are separated as producers, consumers. You know, we wear things that are made, you know, across the world, without us often having any idea of the condition under which they are made, of the situation of the people. You know, we throw away trash that might end up in the fields of an African farmer, you know, to poison their waters and so forth. So there's a tremendous work that we need to do, you know, to rethink our system of production and our system of production and our system of distribution and consumption, so that we are not divided in the way we are now, which in a way are making us irresponsible for the damage that is done to other people across the planet, you know. So these I think are issues that are very concrete and from which we can start right away in our life, you know, and around which I think we need to organize. It's a long road, but I think it's beginning.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. It's been a delight and a great privilege. Thank you again for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Sylvia. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Now, tell our audience how they can access your book, because I think that your book really creates a great understanding of the era that we're seeing and the cyclical nature of violence that is being imposed on us.
It is distributed from Amazon. You can find it. It's on ebook. It's also on ebook, so you can access it there too.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you to you for having me in your program.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.